Our troops are coming back from combat duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, and some are coming home with serious brain injuries. It's the most common form of injury suffered by our troops. Others are arriving back and will be diagnosed with what's called post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. The VA has warned to expect up to one-third of our new vets to be diagnosed with PTSD. Either case, these brave men and women will face months of medical attention, and some will need years. What kind of help are they getting here in Alaska? Find out and join the conversation.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
Good morning, and thank you for being with us today on Talk of Alaska. I'm Pat Yak, filling in for Steve Heimel. We have with us today three experts who will be visiting with us about a very serious issue, the mental and physical health of our troops coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq. You can share your story or ask our guests a question by calling 1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422. You can email us, talk@aprn.org. If you miss any part of the program, you can go to www.aprn.org, and there you can download a copy of the show. With me in the studio this morning are Greg Bilberry. He is a clinical psychologist and the acting chief of social and behavioral services for the VA, and Marsha Hoffman DeVoe, who is also with the VA in the Public Affairs Department. And from the Air Force, Lieutenant Colonel Eric Ashman, a neurologist with the 3rd Medical Group at Elmendorf Air Force Base, and Major Kelly Nevetsky. She is also with the 3rd Medical Group and the director of the TBI clinic at Elmendorf, and that's the traumatic brain injury clinic there at Elmendorf. I want to thank all of you for being with us this morning. Greg, I want to start with you. Recent news reports have indicated that as many as 30 to 35% of the men and women who served in Afghanistan or Iraq are coming back home and are being diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. What's the VA's own expectation about that number? And to put that number a little bit into contrast for us.
Okay, Pat, thank you for having us here this morning. The VA is really geared up and is prepared for the returning troops. We're not seeing quite the numbers that we first thought we would. Initially, we were prepared for more than we were actually seeing. There's a couple of reasons for that. One of the things that when the troops come back from deployment, not all of those troops are getting out of the military, and only about a third of those troops are going to be coming, or I'm sorry, about two-thirds of those troops may be coming out of the military, but then all of those troops are not staying in Alaska. Only about a third of the troops are staying in Alaska when they get out of the military, so that reduces the numbers down quite a bit. The other thing that's important to remember is that not everyone that goes into a military situation or a combat situation has PTSD. We're talking about 20 to 30% of the people will develop PTSD symptoms after combat. So the numbers get smaller as you take those things into consideration. The other thing is that the VA has really geared up our services, and so we've increased the number of providers that we've had, and we've had specialized training for providers to be able to address PTSD directly. So we have psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, people that are trained in specialized therapy techniques to address post-traumatic stress disorder.
What is it about this war that more troops are being diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, actually, I don't think that more troops are being diagnosed. I think we're becoming more aware of the problem. But even back as far as Vietnam, we were still looking at the same type of percentages, 20 to 30% of folks that had been in combat situations come back with post-traumatic stress disorder. I think there's a much greater awareness in the media, and that's a wonderful thing, because recognizing these kind of symptoms early and getting the help is the key. The post-traumatic stress disorder in itself can be very debilitating, but the aftermath of having post-traumatic stress disorder with the broken families, the lost jobs, possible legal issues or DUIs, those are the things we're going to try to prevent this time that we didn't do such a good job of during the Vietnam era.
Talk to me a little bit more about how the VA has beefed up its services of personnel.
Okay, well, I've come back to the Alaska VA as the PTSD specialist. We've also hired several new people that have come on board in the last year. We have a suicide prevention coordinator. Suicide's a topic that, you know, is not something people like to talk about, but it's something we need to be very aware of. Folks with post-traumatic stress disorder are at much higher risk for suicide. So we have a full-time suicide prevention coordinator. We have now on staff three full-time psychiatrists. We also have someone that's called a local recovery coordinator, and if I could explain that a little bit.
Sure.
Dr. Camilla Madden is signed on as our local recovery coordinator. And what we're trying to do is to take a more recovery-based focus with PTSD and other mental health disorders so that it's not such a stigmatized situation that people have to come to mental health. We're trying to set it up more as how do you fully recover and regain your life? And so Dr. Madden has been able to put into place a number of different classes and groups and psychoeducational offerings that help people help themselves. So it's not so much a situation anymore where people go to therapy for years and see their individual therapist, but they come and they learn skills on how to put their lives back together.
What I'm also hearing in your statement is, or your comments, that the VA is working towards or has arrived at a place where this might be considered more normal than not, i.e., you might need some help when you come back, and we're going to be here to provide it, as opposed to you're only abnormal and really need help when you come back.
Absolutely. You know, this post-traumatic stress disorder is a reaction. I like to say it's a normal human reaction to abnormal situations. And so people that are put in these combat situations are having expected reactions to this. The thing that we need to make sure happens is that they don't get stuck in those reactions for long periods of time. We want to help them work out of that and find their way back to normality.
One of the struggles or challenges, maybe is a better word, for the VA here in Alaska is making sure that veterans who live in rural areas out in Bush, Alaska, are getting the access to the VA that vets living in urban areas are. Are the same types of services available in rural and Bush, Alaska? Or do you have to come to Anchorage?
No, you don't have to come to Anchorage, but obviously there are some hurdles to get over when you're talking about hundreds of miles, and we can't necessarily travel providers out to see individual folks in the bush. So what we're trying to do is to pair with native corporations and the local providers in these areas, and we've been on several swings, as we call them, western swing, out to different villages and different hubs to try and provide education to providers there so that people can get their care close to home. We're also setting up what's called a telemental health program where we'll have providers using telemental health equipment talking to patients directly in Bethel and Kotzebue and Kenai even.
Is the experience for a vet coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan different if they were originally from a rural area or a remote area as opposed to an urban area, or is the experience equally as traumatic?
I don't think there's a significant difference in where they came from originally, although there is probably some culture shock to any of us that would travel to a foreign land. But I don't think there's a differentiation between rural and urban folks as far as the PTSD and how that's expressed.
We've been using this word PTSD a lot this morning, and maybe we've been making a presumption that everybody knows what it is, but what is post-traumatic stress disorder?
I'm glad you asked that question, Pat. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a syndrome of symptoms that develops sometimes for people that have been through traumatic events, and it doesn't have to be combat events. People can develop post-traumatic stress disorder from natural disasters, significant car accidents, sexual trauma issues, but the symptoms that they develop for post-traumatic stress disorder seem to cluster around three areas. The traumatic event happens and people start to respond to that by having re-experiencing of that event. And I'm sure the listeners are familiar with the term flashbacks. That's kind of an extreme example of re-experiencing the event. But people also re-experience these traumatic events through nightmares, through just unwanted intrusive thoughts about the event that they went through. Trying to carry on their day-to-day lives and having that always running in the background can be very, very distracting. The second symptom that comes up with post-traumatic stress disorder is avoidance. People tend to want to avoid things that remind them of the trauma, and people also tend to want to avoid personal contact with other people. interpersonal interactions become much more difficult for people with post-traumatic stress disorder because they have a very low tolerance for frustration, and they tend to avoid getting close to people. This is the most concerning symptom because it's that isolation and avoidance and withdrawing that really makes the post-traumatic stress disorder much, much worse.
And I'm sorry for interrupting. I read that our troops that are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, a little bit different than the troops that were in Vietnam, in that they tended to be a little older and have more family or be more family situations. Is that an accurate generalization of the difference between the troops coming back from Vietnam and the troops that are coming back today?
Well, I think you have to take each person on an individual basis. We certainly have some significantly young troops coming back from these situations. But overall, and I guess I'd defer to the active duty folks to talk about those statistics, but I think we do see people that are a little bit older and a little bit more prepared than we had in Vietnam.
I was trying to get at the family issue, though. Are they tend to be married and have families, or are they in the case of Vietnam where they were more single or as apt to be single?
I'm not sure I can answer that directly. I don't have the statistics on that.
Okay.
I will say that people that are connected and have good family support do much better with PTSD and working their way through that situation. People that are single tend to isolate more and tend to have less contact with other people. If there's one message for the families or for the veterans, it is that these veterans most assuredly need to stay connected. They need to be close with family. They need to continue their normal activities. And sometimes that's the very hardest thing for these veterans to do, but that's exactly what they need to do in order to keep the symptoms from getting worse. It's that isolation that's going to enhance the symptoms.
Yeah. I want to remind listeners that they can join the conversation this morning by calling 1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, and they can email us at talk@aprn.org. So if you've got a question or want to share a story, 1-800-478-8255 or 800-478-TALK, and in Anchorage, 550-8422. How is, Greg, sticking with you, how is post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosed? What's the process and what is the actual procedure for diagnosing PTSD?
Well, a veteran would come to the VA. In our case, if it was someone that is a veteran and not someone that's active duty, they would come to the VA and come in the front door of the clinic on DeBar Street and find out what their eligibility is by going to the eligibility clerk. Once we determine that the person is eligible for our services, we like to have them see a primary care provider. We want to rule out any other medical problems and address the whole person. Once that's done and the primary care provider may note that they have post-traumatic stress disorder, they would come up to our clinic on the second floor, and they'd be given an appointment with one of our providers who would go through an interview with them and help determine what their diagnosis is. Oftentimes, PTSD can be accompanied by other disorders, and so we want to make sure that we're also looking for depression, if there's any significant indicators of a traumatic brain injury, and also want to look and see if there's any substance abuse problems or family problems. So they would come to the mental health clinic, and we'd go through a diagnostic interview with them. What we're looking for is the significance of the trauma and how they reacted to it at the time. And then those symptoms that we spoke of earlier, are they re-experiencing these things? Are they avoiding things they used to do and find pleasure in? And there's a specific criteria that you go through to diagnose PTSD. People can have symptoms of PTSD but not meet the full diagnostic criteria as well.
Let me turn my attention just for a minute to the active duty folks that are with us today. I'll direct this question to you, Lieutenant Colonel Ashman. We're talking about the diagnosis of PTSD. Tell us a little bit about what that's like. What are the types of things that somebody, a patient, might undergo when they're being diagnosed or going through the process of being diagnosed?
One of the challenges with diagnosing PTSD is that there are a lot of similarities in the symptoms between PTSD and traumatic brain injury of any severity. There are a lot of overlapping symptoms. For instance, there are a lot with either disorder, a soldier or an airman could have problems with memory, have problems with thinking and concentration, have difficulties with irritability, have sleep problems, have problems with chronic pain, perception of chronic pain, have problems with social interactions and family interactions. There's a lot of overlap, and sometimes it's difficult to distinguish between the two because very often they go together, and very often it's difficult to try to elicit a full spectrum of symptoms from somebody that you're interviewing. Sometimes they're a little bit hesitant to disclose something, which they're embarrassed or a little bit uncertain to talk about. There are times where somebody is concerned about their career, the career implications, and how it may affect them being able to continue an active duty service. So sometimes it's not always easy, and very often they go hand in hand. An individual who has mild traumatic brain injury also has post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Let me follow up a little bit with you, Colonel Ashman, about this issue of diagnosis. If I don't feel right, my head seems to hurt. If I'm dizzy, I'm blanking out. I can't concentrate. Could that mean that I have a brain injury, a physical brain injury, or does that mean that I could have post-traumatic stress?
It could mean both. Again, the symptoms overlap, and a lot of times you have to provide or you have to engage in a very detailed history about what that active duty member went through, whether in their overseas tour. You have to get very specific into details as far as how many times they may have been near blasts or been involved in motor vehicle accidents or may have been subject to falls, and try to establish the timing between exposures to those things and the onset of some of their symptoms. Most commonly, it's expected that when somebody has suffered a mild traumatic brain injury, that a lot of the symptoms they experience will develop within the first 30 days after being exposed to a particular trigger, such as an explosion or an accident. Sometimes that can be a clue. Other clues can be, for instance, in individuals with mild traumatic brain injury, or even more severe forms of traumatic brain injury, headaches are more common. And if they present with headaches as being a very predominant symptom, a lot of times that can give you a clue that that's probably due more to a traumatic brain injury than post-traumatic stress, although that's not always a rule. If somebody presents with a lot of problems with difficulty sleeping, nightmares, a lot of individuals who just have mild traumatic brain injury don't experience those. So you may be more inclined to think that some of their symptoms, at least in part, are due to post-traumatic stress syndrome.
You alluded to something that might be a little bit touchy, but I'd like for you to talk about this just for a moment, and that is this issue of not coming forward if you think that you have post-traumatic stress. I think the military has tried to address this issue of the stigma that's been attached to post-traumatic stress, where there's maybe not a stigma that's been attached to a physical brain injury. I think anybody who's ever watched the movie Patton, one of the most indelible moments there is George C. Scott slapping the soldier that's there in the hospital or the sick bay or whatever and saying, you know, something like, you know, you got to toughen up, you got to get back out there kind of thing. How has the military worked to make it okay to come forward for its troops to say, you know, if you think you've got an issue, step forward and we'll try to address it. We'll try to handle that.
From my perspective, what I've seen has been the most effective tool is education. All the branches of the service have been very proactive in trying to educate line commanders and also non-commissioned officers and everybody at various levels in a active duty member's chain of command to become more familiar with what the signs and symptoms are of post-traumatic stress syndrome and mild traumatic brain injury, education on the fact that they can come together, and stressing the importance of very often that it is a normal reaction to an abnormal situation and that most people are expected to improve. It's the expectation of improvement and recovery which I personally think has allowed more people to come forward. A lot of soldiers and airmen that I've worked with have expressed concern about the impact on their military careers. We now know that even though it does take some time, sometimes order months or longer, for individuals to improve, that it does occur. And given that optimism, that feeling that they are going to improve and be able to return to their normal duties, I think in a large way has allowed folks to come forward and discuss their symptoms more openly.
Be more at ease about it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Major Nowetzki, I don't want to leave you out, but I do want to take a couple of calls here. And we have George from Anchorage. George, welcome to Talk of Alaska. George, we lost you. Sorry. Okay. Then let's go to, I think it's Guy from Valdez.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about 30-35% of these guys coming back, you know, with these problems. What about what's going on in, you know, in Afghanistan, you know, in Iraq, with the population over there? Shouldn't you be seeing those numbers over there, too, with the people? And is anything being done to help them? And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you. Bye.
Okay. All right. Who wants to fill that one? Greg?
Yeah, this is Greg from the VA. And while we're not directly involved over there, certainly you're going to see the same type of symptom patterns with the civilian population that are exposed to the same traumatic events. I don't know what their healthcare system is like there. I suspect they don't have quite the resources that they need. But you would see, as I mentioned earlier, the post-traumatic stress disorder is not specific to a combat soldier or even combat. People that are exposed to this kind of trauma will develop these symptoms. Now, the good news is that with the kind of family support and community support that they have, many people will get better without going to formal therapy. We hope to see that people going through formal therapy or formal interventions with the professionals may improve quicker, but people have a natural capacity to heal as well. And so my heart goes out to those folks that don't have any resources, but they will be able to hopefully network with their own communities and find ways to heal themselves. But you're very, very much correct that they will have civilian post-traumatic stress disorder as well.
Joe from Fort Wainwright, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
How you doing?
We're doing great.
Good. My question was in reference to the suicide issue more. I'm active in the Army, and that's been a very large issue in the last couple of years for us. As I have kind of observed that not all of those issues are necessarily associated with combat. And so my question is what I is being directed towards being able to gauge a soldier's response to collective issues, deployment, prior life issues, whatever, maybe pre-existing thing may have been going on with them, family, etc. I'll take my response off air.
Okay, thanks. Major, Colonel?
When an active duty soldier comes in for evaluation at Elmendorf, they generally, in addition to a general medical exam, get interviewed and screened for psychological problems. Questions are asked in regards to family interactions and if there's any dysfunction with that. I know me personally in my clinic, every soldier that comes through and every airman that comes through that I interview, I ask about how things are going with family dynamics and always ask about the thought of hurting themselves or someone else. And I think in general throughout the third medical group, that's an established practice. So as long as an individual is, you know, forthright and will discuss it openly with us, I think we identify a lot of soldiers who are struggling with that. And that type of screening not only occurs on their initial in-processing through our clinic, it throughout the member's course of treatment, those issues are typically repeatedly assessed because things change over time. family dynamics changes over time as families struggle with the active duty member to cope with these conditions. So I'd like to think that we maintain a relatively high level of vigilance for identifying those things. Again, a lot of times it depends on the individuals themselves being able to and willing to discuss those things with us openly.
Yeah, I see. We have an email here, and I wanted to read it before we take a brief break. This is Carol from Ketchikan saying, please clarify that a veteran can go to VA and where in the country. If veterans live in Southeast Alaska, they do not have to go to Anchorage. They can go to Seattle VA. Marcia?
Yes. Many of our veterans in Southeast Alaska do travel to the VA in Seattle. And in fact, for specialty care here in Alaska, even veterans that come to the Anchorage based clinic will be referred to Seattle for very specialized treatment. Seattle does have a specialized post-traumatic stress disorder unit. So many of our Alaska veterans do receive treatment from Seattle.
I see. Okay. We are going to take a break here. We've been talking with experts about post-traumatic stress disorder, and we're going to talk a little bit about brain injuries. We're going to follow up about both, about our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you can join our conversation today as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Tel Alaska, a telecommunications company proud to support public broadcasting, sharing the spirit of communications across the Great Land. Voice data and Wi-Fi technologies at Tel Alaska. On the web at telalaska.com. Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Pat Yak, and I'm filling in for Steve Heimel. With us today are three experts who will be visiting with us about a very serious issue, the mental and physical health of our troops coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq. You can share your story, or you can ask our guests a question by calling 1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK. If you're in Anchorage, you can call 550-8422. Or you can email us, talk@APRN.org. If you miss any part of the show today, you can go to APN.org and get the show. You can download it, and you can also subscribe to our podcast there. I know, Greg, you wanted to leave a very important number.
Yes, thank you, Pat. There's a national hotline in regard to suicide, and I appreciate the caller earlier mentioning, you know, suicide's not something that's specifically a danger for folks with post-traumatic stress disorder. It's just something that's an increased probability or a risk with post-traumatic stress disorder. But I think all of our servicemen and women are in high-stress situations and can get that feeling of being lost and seeing no hope. There's an 800 number I want to give out to you, and it's on a little bumper sticker I have, and I think the title of the sticker is interesting. It says, it takes the courage and strength of a warrior to ask for help, and it really does take a lot of courage to reach out, but it's important to know that if you're struggling with thoughts of suicide, those can get worse if you keep them to yourself, and those can get better if you reach out for some help. So the 800 number that I want you to write down is 1-800-273-8255. It's 1-800-273-TALK or 8255. That's manned 24/7 by trained professional counselors. They will be able to talk with you. You can do it anonymously or you can give information. They can give you local resources wherever you are in the country. They have a fabulous network set up. So you are a family member of someone that's having thoughts of suicide, need to call this hotline so that we can get some help for them.
Thank you for that number. And we'll be happy to post that number too at APRN as well. Greg. Major, tell us about the Traumatic Brain Injury Clinic at Elmendorf. It's relatively new, and Tell us about what goes on there.
It is fairly new, excuse me. we see approximately 35 patients that are actively involved in our clinic right now. Over the past year, we've screened 140-plus patients with symptoms of TBI. They're referred to us through their primary care managers. When they come to us, they get a head-to-toe assessment. They get a thorough screening exam, multi-tiered assessment. We have several subspecialties involved in the TBI clinic. We have the neurology clinic. We have occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech pathology, who does all our cognitive rehab with our patients. We have audiology, ophthalmology, all the subspecialties that we need for these patients, including mental health. About 98% of our patients that we have in our clinic are diagnosed both with TBI and PTSD.
What is it? I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
What is it about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan that have made head injuries the most common injury?
I think it's the type of war that we're in. The roadside bombs, the rocket-propelled grenades. Our soldiers, service members, are exposed to more of the blast injuries, and if they're close to the impact, it shakes them up in their heads. You know, they're in the helmets, and it increases their risk of head injury.
Is there an incidence of service that you are providing or treatment that you are providing that's greater than what we experienced in Vietnam?
I don't know if it's greater than. It's just more, we're more aware, and I think the injuries are different in this war than in past wars.
And I'm curious about something. I know that you're treating the patient here. What kind of information is gathered, not in a personal way, but as you treat these injuries, either about the types of equipment that our men and women need, the changes in the equipment or the changes in the tactics that might make it our troops less vulnerable, I guess?
Honestly, we haven't been addressing that at our level.
Yeah, so. Okay. So what happens? Play like I'm a patient and I'm coming into the clinic. What happens? Walk our listeners through what happens to me as a patient when I come into your clinic.
Sure. Upon redeployment, when you return from your deployment, you go through a physical exam, questionnaires. If there's any, some of these screeners have indications where, you know, if you were involved in a blast, that you could have undergone a brain injury, you're referred to us in the TBI clinic. When we receive the referral, we set you up an appointment with a primary care manager who does a head-to-toe assessment. Again, it's a multi-tiered assessment, and we address pain, we address sleeping, headaches, mood, memory, substance abuse. We go through the whole gamut. Once we obtain all that information, we're able to refer out to all the subspecialties. So if your primary complaint is headaches, neurology, is where you'll be referred to. Pain, we have pain clinics. Sleep, we have a sleep clinic. And all the referrals, all the reports come back to our hub in the TBI clinic, and then we're able to follow up with that care and ensure continuity.
What is the reporting mechanism between the active military and the VA? I've done my deployments. I've come back. In the old days, there were sort of parallel universities, both the military and the VA worked to strengthen the reporting relationship between the two. Who wants to field that one?
Colonel
Ashman.
This is Dr. Ashman. The historically, the initial interaction between the DOD and the VA has been when we know an active duty member is going to require what's called a medical board, which means that they need to be assessed to determine if their medical condition is severe enough to allow them to continue on active duty service. There's a federal law which now establishes, once an individual is identified as requiring a medical board, that they also, at the same time, start a VA disability evaluation. And for about the past year, that mechanism has been in place. locally, what we are actively doing now is we have what's called a Tiger Team that we formed, where we have representatives from both the Third Medical Group and the VA who are meeting to coordinate our efforts. And we're starting to establish programs where we are more freely interacting with each other for active duty members, because at this point, a lot of folks who are getting their disability evaluations are still active duty. So we're making greater strides in more open communication, and also, too, we're starting to share our subspecialty services. For instance, I, as a neurologist, on the active duty side, we've opened our clinic to see veterans. And efforts are being made across the board in mental health and other subspecialty care to do the same thing. And that's a work in progress, but we anticipate within the next couple months that our level of interaction on a more daily basis is going to increase substantially.
Yeah, I see. I want to take a caller, Emma, who is in the Mat-Su. Emma, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, thank you.
Did you have a question?
I did.
Okay.
I've been listening in, and I am an active duty Air Force spouse whose husband is deployed right now over to Afghanistan. And I've been listening to how you're saying that, you know, families can be at backup help. And as far as the PTSD, I have a couple of questions.
Okay.
First one being, when they went over the first time and came back, a majority of the people I know were diagnosed with anxiety, which I'm wondering if they were trying to avoid diagnosing them with post-traumatic stress disorder. And what does that mean to them this time coming back? Does it increase the likelihood of PTSD, or are they going to keep them with the diagnosis of anxiety? Also, my other question.
Can we do one? Emma, I'm sorry for a minute. Let's do one of these at a time. Greg.
Yes, Emma. Thank you for your call. There is a distinction between anxiety and post-traumatic stress disorder, and I think the difference is that post-traumatic stress disorder is a type of anxiety disorder, but it has a much higher level of criteria that you have to meet. So lots of people can have anxiety but not reach the level of being diagnosed as post-traumatic stress disorder. So I don't know that they were trying to avoid the diagnosis. It may be the person has not met that level of disorder to be called post-traumatic stress disorder. The interesting thing with post-traumatic stress disorder, the first word being post, is it takes time to develop for people, and so people may not have the full symptom picture of post-traumatic stress disorder until months or even years later, and they may not necessarily develop that. The other thing you mentioned is that, do people being re-exposed to trauma have a greater incidence of developing PTSD? And unfortunately, the answer to that question is yes. The more times people go back in deployments, the more likelihood they are to have, more likely they are to have problems with post-traumatic stress disorder later. The important thing to remember is to intervene early with these folks so that once they have these symptoms of PTSD, they get some help so that those symptoms don't worsen and cause more collateral damage in their life, if you will, more family problems, more employment problems, and further emotional problems. So I guess the short answer is that anxiety is a different diagnosis than PTSD. Certainly if someone has anxiety, they could develop PTSD later. And further exposure is an increased risk factor. The positive side of that is that people that have been in those situations before have developed coping mechanisms, so people may actually do better on a second or third deployment than they did the first because they've adjusted somewhat to the trauma that they're dealing with.
Colonel Ashman, did you want to add anything to that? Okay. Emma, what was your second question?
The second question was actually regarding the families. As the family that's here, I'm aware that in the Army they have a more set system for when they deploy. They deploy in groups and their families have backup. Air Force, not so much. My husband is on his second one, once again on his own. And I've not even had a call from his unit to check on me. So I'm wondering, how are we supposed to be a backup for these members when they come home when we have no backup ourselves?
Emmett, thanks for calling Talk of Alaska this morning.
I can't speak for an active duty member's individual. This is Dr. Ashman. Can't speak for an active duty member's individual unit, but I can tell you that most units that I am aware of, there is very proactive efforts to keep the family engaged. They will have a representative from the unit contact family members at home periodically to check and make sure things are okay. If you have not had that, the thing I would suggest doing is possibly contacting somebody at the unit, and probably the best person to talk to would be to try to speak with the unit first sergeant. That's usually one of the senior non-commissioned officers in the unit. If you have concerns about not getting contacted or not being able to reach any support mechanisms. In addition to that, though, too, at the 3rd Medical Group, there's always an open door for anybody, active duty or dependents, to come in as a walk-in to be to get some help or guidance if you're struggling with particular stresses of your own or struggling with how to interact with an active duty person who has a mild traumatic brain injury or PTSD. We do have various group and individual programs that you can get engaged in. In addition to that, there are often spouses groups on base and other groups that through religious organizations on base that you can refer to too if you need to seek out that type of help.
I see.
I also want to piggyback on this. This is Major Novetsky. Along with the family support, we've taken into consideration the spouses and also the children of these service members that are coming back with either post-traumatic stress or the TBI. We're starting up groups, support groups for spouses, and your spouse does not have to be involved in the TBI clinic. It's going to be open to anybody, and it's walk-in through the mental health clinic. We're also offering support groups for children. We have several specialists in our clinic who deal primarily with children, and we've noticed, you know, why is mommy and daddy coming back different? They have questions, too, so we're opening that up to everybody. And also the Family Support, Airman and Family Readiness Center has a list of lots of support out there in the community, as well as on Fort Ridge, Elmendorf, and every base has that available to not only the spouses but active duty members as well.
I see.
Yeah. Oh, one additional thing. This is Dr. Ashman again. If you wanted to seek out other resources too, you can go online and look up Military One Source, and that should be Military One Source, all one word, .org.
Okay.
And they have links that you can go to where you can call. They have mental health providers and counselors that are available 24/7 as well.
Okay. Good. Brenda, I know that you've been on hold for a few minutes, and I appreciate your patience. Thank you for calling Talk of Alaska.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a health aide in Deering in the clinic, and our hub hospital is in Kotzebue, and I was just wondering if the VA could send providers to the hub hospitals. I know ANMC sends providers up that we don't have here in Kotzebue. And I was just wondering if the VA can do that. And I'll hang up now and listen to your response, and thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Brenda. Marcia, Greg?
This is Greg, Dr. Bilberry. Appreciate the call from Kotzebue. Glad to hear from you out there. You know, Alaska is a unique setting, and it's difficult to spread our resources out to where the people are located, and that's a difficult situation. We have made some swings out into those villages to do education for the providers that are there. We simply don't have the resources to put providers in every village or even every hub at this point in time. So what we're trying to do is partner with the people that are there, give them some training, and we're in the process. We've just hired a specialist that works specifically in telemental health, and this person has equipment here in Anchorage that can directly link to equipment in all of the hubs and talk either directly to the providers and give them guidance on what we would suggest for PTSD or traumatic brain injury, or specifically see patients in those areas where the patient would sit in front of a monitor and camera and have a two-way conversation real-time, live, with a provider back here in Anchorage. Now, those are not completely developed at this point. This person has been on board here for about 2 months, and she's trying to get all those links developed and set up those situations where she or any of our other providers can link in by telemental health. A number of our groups that we offer here in Anchorage, such as anger management and the insomnia group that we have and the depression group that we have, we're hoping to offer those by that VTEL link so that people in the outlying areas could go to the hub and basically attend the group in a virtual manner, and that they would be audio and video linked to the group, could ask questions and could interact. We're a few months off from that probably, but we're trying to develop that because we do recognize the need, especially in the rural areas in Alaska where there's not as many resources.
That's great. Thanks. We're going to take a break here in a second. We've been talking with experts about post-traumatic stress disorder and brain injuries suffered by our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. You can join our conversation about this topic today as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood, and together looking toward a bright future.
This flu season, every Alaskan should roll up their sleeves and fight the flu by making plans to get both the swine flu and regular seasonal flu vaccines. In the meantime, you can fight the flu by regularly disinfecting hard surfaces, avoid touching your mouth, nose, and eyes, and wear a face mask if you are sick and in close contact with others. For more information on how to fight the flu, go to pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Good morning. This is Pat Yak, and I'm filling in for Steve Heimel on Talk of Alaska today. We have with us today three experts who will be visiting with us about the very serious issue, the mental and physical health of our troops coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq. You can call us at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422. You can email us at talk@APRN.org. And if you miss any part of the program, you can go to APRN.org, and there you can download a copy of the show later this afternoon. With me in the studio are Greg Bilberry, who is a clinical psychologist with the VA, Marsha Hoffman DeVoe, who is with the VA in the Public Affairs Office, Lieutenant Colonel Eric Ashman, who's a neurologist with the 3rd Medical Group at Elmendorf Air Force Base, and Major Kelly Nevetsky, and she is the director of the TBI clinic at Elmendorf. Lieutenant Colonel, let me come back to a question that I think one of our callers asked was, if I or my husband or loved one is coming back and I have been diagnosed or it's been made aware that I have anxiety and I'm going to go back again, and there's a large chance that I'm going to have post-traumatic stress as a result of that, how is that soldier, that airman, that sailor, that Marine worked with in the field knowing that that's the case?
Well, I think it's important to note that assessments about an active duty member's well-being occurs before they're even notified that they're being deployed. At least once a year, every active duty member is required to go through medical and mental health screening. So if there are issues regarding anxiety or depression or post-traumatic stress, the screening and the questionnaires that are involved in that are designed to identify individuals before they are even set to redeploy. When somebody is out in the field, depending upon the level of care that's near them, sometimes the most immediate level of healthcare provider is a corpsman or an Air Force medic. Those individuals go through rather extensive training on being able to identify individuals who may be at risk for combat stress, post-traumatic stress, or other anxiety problems. And if those are identified, then they are, the expected course is that they get referred through higher levels of medical care from there. A lot of individuals can be taken care of in theater, and that's an important thing to emphasize. Sometimes it just requires several days of rest and recuperation away from the combat situation, and they're able to go back to their units and continue just fine. It's a very small percentage of individuals who develop enough anxiety or develop a mental health disorder that doesn't allow them to be able to maintain, stay with their units.
Mm-hmm. So, I wonder if I could come back to the clinic for a minute and what goes on there. After I have been processed in or processed through or admitted to the clinic, and I undergo various types of treatments there, what happens to me next after I leave the clinic? Am I put back into my regular unit? Am I discharged? Am I assigned a different kind of position?
It actually depends on the individual, how they respond to treatment. If the person, if we feel that they need to be, they're not duty compatible, they go through a medical evaluation board to determine whether or not they were Y qualified. Some are actually retrained, while others will, you know, their prognosis is good and they go back to duty with no complications.
Greg, back to you for a minute. You left a very important 1-800 number for us. What other counsel would you be giving to those vets who are listening this morning?
Well, first I'd like to emphasize that while we're focusing on the OEF, OIF, which is Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom vets on this program, the VA has not forgotten about the other veterans that we serve, and I want to encourage those vets to continue to seek help as well. You know, we can get a lot of emphasis on this current situation and leave folks that have served in the past feeling like we forgot about them, and we certainly haven't. The other thing I want to mention is that we have an OEF, OIF team specifically for those veterans.
Excuse me, what does that mean?
Oh, excuse me. That's the acronyms of the VA. OEF is Operation Enduring Freedom, and OIF is Operation Iraqi Freedom. So we refer to the two as OEF, OIF. These are the folks coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. If a veteran falls into that category, we have a team that tries to help them walk through the system, and they can contact them directly if they're at the VA. But the most important message that I want to reach out to all the veterans with is that we do want you to come in and seek help. People with post-traumatic stress disorder can either get better or get worse. And by seeking help and coming in and engaging in what we have to offer, we certainly believe we can help you get better. The symptoms that we're most see most prominently are sleep disorder and anger and irritability. And we have specific treatments for both of those, and we want to encourage the vets to come in. We have contact numbers for Anchorage, for Fairbanks, and for the Kenai Clinic and the Mat-Su Clinic that we have that I'll either leave here on air or post later. So, but the message is to get help, and the message to the families is to provide the support and encouragement to that veteran to get them to come in and get the help and to help them see that it's a way of getting better and a way of getting stronger.
Yeah. Lieutenant Colonel Ashman, for those listeners, what message would you have for them?
I have several. The first is that we are more prepared now than we have been in being able to identify and actively treat individuals who have mild traumatic brain injury and PTSD. I think the most important thing for individuals to realize, though, in addition to that, is that the expectation of recovery. It is a very small percentage. Out of all individuals who get any form of mild traumatic brain injury, it's only about 10% who have symptoms that last more than a few months. And even in those individuals where they have symptoms that last more than a few months, the vast majority of them are going to improve and be able to resume relatively normal or completely normal lifestyles over time. Now, it's a slow process. This process can take many months, sometimes a year or more, and it often involves being involved with healthcare providers in different areas of expertise. But we do know that the vast, vast majority of people improve and recover and are able to return to doing what they were doing before.
Major, what about you?
I agree with Dr. Ashman. The majority of our patients recover and do well after 90 days. They're back to work. The other thing to I want to really stress is that we have state-of-the-art treatment modalities here at Third Med Group. We have the only virtual reality therapy in the state.
Which is what?
It's actually set up kind of like a video game. The individual with post-traumatic stress stands on a board that moves. It simulates whatever environment that they were in that caused their stress, traumatic stress. We have virtual Afghanistan, virtual Iraq, puts them in the situation, and it's been validated and that it works. So we use that along with prolonged exposure therapy. And many of these patients are returned to duty and function normally.
And what is going on when I'm in the virtual Afghanistan?
You're actually put in a similar situation that you experienced when you were in Afghanistan.
And that attempts to do what?
Expose them to what they what caused their stress, their trauma, facing their fear. Reliving it and knowing that they're okay.
Oh, I see. So it's not to scare them again. It's to build confidence.
Build confidence, and we use that along with the prolonged exposure therapy.
Yeah. How long have you been doing that?
We've been doing it in our clinic within the year. I don't know exactly how long, but it's been within the year that we received all the equipment. All our providers are trained in virtual reality therapy.
And the outcomes are showing that this is a good way to further diagnose or to help someone?
To help someone, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, well, this has been a great topic for us to be talking about this morning. And as our men and women come back from Afghanistan and Iraq, from Fort Richardson and Fort Wainwright, and from other positions around the country, and are seeking help and getting help from the military and from the Veterans Administration. So I want to thank all of our guests, Major Nevetsky and Lieutenant Colonel Ashman and Marsha Hoffman DeVoe and Greg Bilberry. Thank all of you for being on Talk of Alaska with us today. Steve Heimel is expected to be back next week. I'm Pat Yak, and I've appreciated the opportunity to sit in for Steve during the past few weeks. And I appreciate all of you calling in and sharing your stories with us on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline,
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future,
and by Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years, online at reddogalaska.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.